This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who have some stories that are kind of hard to believe if you take the time to listen, people who have put their lives on the line for our freedom. And every week we meet members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And we sure do learn a lot along the way. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired. And those kind of things happen all the time where I am today at the Warhawk Air Museum in Nampa, Idaho. And one of the guys whose collection got this museum started a quarter century ago is our guest today, 92-year-old Bill Gornick, originally from Pennsylvania. He lives now here in the Boise area. Meridian, is that where you are, Bill?
Meridian.
There's a lot of great parts of this Boise community, and it's a community that loves its veterans, and we're going to hear more about that throughout this. But I want to talk about your childhood, Bill, because you're one of eight kids growing up in a family. Your father had immigrated from what is now Slovenia. What was life like growing up as the number two son in that family of eight kids?
You have to know how it was in those days where people in Europe had a special way of treating the number one son. He was kind of the favorite. He was the junior.
He was like a prince.
Right. And the number two son was kind of a secondary. For example, as children to go to first grade, my brother being a year older than I was, my father, he wanted his two sons to someday play football. My father's idea was, because he was a big fan of Stilton High School football and also a big Notre Dame fan.
He's a Newt Rockne kind of guy, huh?
Right. Anyhow, he wanted his two sons to go through school together so that ultimately, in his mind, he wanted his number one son to be the quarterback of Stilton High School and his younger brother would be the fullback. He actually believed that. As it turned out, when we did go to high school, high school never even had a football team.
Oh, really?
As it turned out. But I just want to give you an idea of what the mindset was as far as being the number two son. That's how it was back in those days. He was the good-looking one in the family. He was the special privileges. He got them. And I was relegated more or less as a subordinate.
Let me ask you about, I'm looking at when your birthday is, December 5th. So that means that 2 days after your 19th birthday is when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
What do you remember about that? How did you find out?
In Pennsylvania, different nationalities usually had their own school and their old church and everything. And of course, in Pennsylvania, you had the blue laws where bars were closed on Sundays. Most of the larger churches had their own, like a social club, and mm-hmm. may have a building where they had a bar and everything, and it was legal. On December 7th, we were all the same group playing polka music, and dances, you know, and during all the noise and everything, somebody yelled out that the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. The whole place quieted. And it was kind of somber because now we know we're in the war. I kept working at the steel mill, and of course, I was like all the young men in those days. I was ready to go off to war, and I wasn't old enough to, until you were 20 years old, you had to have somebody sign for you.
Right.
And my father didn't want to sign papers, so I go off to war. And finally, until we read the paper where the Germans had invaded Slovenia, which was Yugoslavia in those days, had no way of knowing if his mother, my grandma, was still alive or what happened to her. So he got mad and he says, okay, I'll sign the papers.
The Nazis had overtaken the city where he grew up.
Yeah.
And you didn't know if your grandparents were alive or dead.
That's correct. And then he, like I say, he got mad and he says he assumed I'd probably go in the army and get a rifle and go shoot Germans, but that's not what happened.
Because you wanted to get into airplanes.
Yeah.
You are a rare guy in so many ways. Not too many guys can wear that hat that says World War II and Vietnam veteran, and not too many can have a B-25 pin on one side and an SR-71 on the other. Those are two very, very different airplanes,
but
you had experience with both of them. And you actually flew an airplane before you drove a car.
That's correct.
Not too many people can say that. But tell me why you wanted to get into the Army Air Corps. What was it about flying?
Ever since I was a could read, I would say, I used to get, because we didn't have any money to buy magazines or whatever, but I used to listen to the radio. I remember one radio program. I still remember the pilot's name was Lieutenant Harrington. And it was very vivid. Of course, we didn't have no TV in those days. And I used to run home from school just to listen to this particular serial on the radio. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to be a fighter pilot.
That's why you like hanging out with the P-40s here at the Warhawk Air Museum.
Right. When I went in service then, I figured I'd go and get into the cadets and fly. Up until this time, of course, I never drove a car and never even had a bicycle.
Hmm.
Since I couldn't be a pilot right away, I was assigned to go to engine mechanic school and graduated from there. When I joined the Army Air Corps, he took a test, and apparently my IQ test was high enough that when I applied for cadets, because at that time you had to have college education to get into cadets, unless you had a higher IQ. And apparently mine was high enough that it negated need for college education, so I was accepted into the cadets. Pre-flight school, where it's all classroom-type work, you know, navigation and that type of thing,
mm-hmm.
and code. Well, I breezed through the pre-flight school okay. Mm-hmm. So the next step was to go to primary school, where you start learning to fly. So they sent me to Quiro, Texas, and had a little couple of dual flights, in which I really loved. I was happy as can be. But the fact that I'd never driven a car or even had a bicycle, you know, apparently I didn't have the dexterity that's necessary to be a good pilot.
Mm.
And even though I flew solo for so many hours, and as an Army officer give you a check ride, and he says, you're not progressing fast enough, you can't be a pilot. Because I was devastated.
Yeah.
You know, to me, that was just like sticking a knife in me and telling me that I can't do something. Well, I didn't accept that, but the fact that we were at war, I had to accept it, and ended up going to gunnery school to fly anyhow.
Right.
Become a crew member. And I breezed through that all right. I was assigned to become a crew member on a bomber, because I did finish airplane engine mechanic school in good shape, finished the gunnery school in good shape. And my first assignment then was to go to Columbia, South Carolina, where I was assigned to what they call a five-man B-25 crew.
Mm-hmm.
I say five-man B-25 crew because normally B-25s had a six-man crew. The B-25 that I was assigned to become a crew member on was a B-25H, which did not have a bombardier, because that particular model airplane had a cannon in the nose as opposed to bomb sights. We didn't have a co-pilot. The guy that flew in the co-pilot seat was actually a navigator cannoneer. It was his job to hand load the cannon, which I did most of the time anyhow in combat.
And where was your position on the B-25?
Engineer gunner, because I did the maintenance, and mm-hmm. it was a top turret. And anyhow, when we finished the training, I had a very unique crew. When I talked to the students here at the museum, I enjoyed talking about the crew because it was so unique. For example, a pilot was, I think it was a Mormon boy from Ranch in Wyoming, and the navigator, cannoneer, he was a Jewish guy from Cleveland, Ohio. In my case, I was born and raised a Catholic. I was a steel worker from Pennsylvania. The radio man was a Presbyterian from Detroit, Michigan, and a concert pianist. Really, really super nice guy. And then the tail gunner was a Southern boy from South Carolina, obviously a Southern Baptist. So we had five guys from all over the United States, all different backgrounds. It's kind of unique, but anyhow,
you guys were the melting pot.
After about 6 months of training, where we flew together, we ate together, we recreated, everything we did together, when we finally got qualified as a combat crew, any one of the five guys would have gladly died for the other. That's how close we were. And until we were finally qualified and got orders to go to Savannah, Georgia, and pick up a brand new B-25, which was a J model, had a bombardier nose and all that.
Mm-hmm.
With orders to fly that halfway around the world to Kunming, China.
And you picked up an additional crew member at this point?
Yeah, we picked up a navigator who had made that trip back and forth with different crews. By the way, he on one of his trips back, he was actually killed in a C-47 crash. And anyhow, flew down to Key West, Florida. From there, we flew to Brinkman Field, Puerto Rico. Spent about 10 days there because by that time they were starting to get ready for the big push into Europe, and that got all the priorities for aircraft because our orders were to go to Kunming, China to deliver that airplane to the 14th Air Force.
But you made it all the way to Kunming, all right?
Oh, yeah. Left in February 22nd and got to Kunming, China in April. That was 2 months. When we got to Kunming, China, we turned the airplane over to the Flying Tigers. Then we were assigned to 491st Bomb Squadron in Yangkai, China, which is about 65 miles from Kunming. We were hoping that we'd, of course, right away start flying combat missions. That's what we were trained for. However, they had a rule in those days that crews couldn't fly as a complete crew until they had some experience. So maybe I would fly with some experienced crew and the pilot would fly with somebody else. You do this for about first four or five missions.
So they split up your crew and put you piecemeal with different crews to get you experience before you can come back together and fly together.
So we were there about maybe three missions or so. The navigator and myself didn't fly that day, and the pilot, radio man, and the tail gunner flew with another crew. It's just only 3 weeks after we got over, and they're still there. We lost them.
What happened?
To this day, have no idea whether they were shot down or weather or whatever. It just never came back. Hopefully, maybe someday they'll find it. I don't know.
So the plane has never been found?
Never.
A B-25?
That's right.
Do you remember their names?
Oh, yeah. Bill Rowe is a pilot. Robert Flansworth, radio man, and Floyd Johnson, tail gunner.
How did that news hit you at the time? Because you already told us how close the five of you, as diverse as you were, had become. And then you find out that they were killed or at least didn't come back.
You know, the impact, like for me, I had never lost anybody in the family and no brothers or sisters. To me, it was just horrible. And then I asked the maintenance officer if I could fly, you know, work down on the flight line just to stay busy and learn more. Because I was ignorant. I was not a qualified engineer because we never got the training, hands-on training as engineers. And in fact, I'll give you a good example. When we left the United States and flew to Puerto Rico, the pilot didn't get good instructions on where to park the airplane. We actually parked in the wrong area, and the rest of the crew, they went into operations to find out, you know, what was going to happen for the next couple of days. And they left me and the tail gunner with the airplane with his Thompson machine gun to sit under the airplane, guard the airplane because we had a high classified bomb sight and IFF, which was very critical.
And so, that's identification, friend or foe.
Right. Yep. Anyhow, here comes a staff sergeant in a Jeep. He comes up to us and he says, who's the crew chief on this airplane? I was engineer gunner, so I guess you mean me. And he says, well, you have to move your airplane over. We pointed about a quarter of a mile away. Take your airplane over there and park it with all those other B-25s and B-26s, you know, bomber types. I said, well, how soon are you going to send a tug out? He said, tug? He says, taxi it over. And I didn't have the guts to tell him that I never even started the engine on a B-25, let alone taxi it. I did fly, you know, an airplane with a single engine. Mm-hmm. I never taxied a tricycle landing airplane, you know.
Yeah.
Mine was PT-19, was a tail dragger. Mm-hmm. And I says, okay. I didn't have the nerve to tell that guy that I didn't know how. Johnny, the tail dragger, he says, Bill, are you going to taxi? Yeah. The thing is that where we were parked, field was separated by a drainage ditch.
Uh-oh.
And the only way to get over that was a kind of little ramp that was just wide enough for tricycle gear to go across. Tail gunner said, I'm not going to ride with you. So I said, well, it's good. You watch, you know. So I started the engine. I got them started all right. And I stacked it with the throttles. So I didn't trust the brakes. And then it got to this place where I lined. And I said, now I'm going to line this up on this crossover.
Right.
I says, when I lay its nose wheel straight, give me the signal. And I just poured the coal on, and off we went over the other side. And by that time, of course, I'm soaking wet, you know, sweating.
Yeah.
And we got over to the park that we were supposed to, and the crew came out, and they said, I'll taxi it over.
No big deal. Always up for a challenge. Could not be truer words when it comes to Bill Gornick, 92 years old of Meridian, Idaho. When we come back, we're going to hear about some of his 46 B-25 missions in the China-Burma-India theater during World War II, and about the bomb that landed just a couple feet away from him. How in the world is he still here? Find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.